right now, a lot of the discussion is, should we geoengineer, as if it's this one moment where a button is pressed and then geoengineering is turned on and we're doing geoengineering, whoever we is. And that's not actually a very helpful way to think about it. A better way to think about it is a limited time intervention that takes the climate from this pretty risky state that we're in now towards a more stable, livable, for many species, healthy type of state. And the question is not about doing geoengineering, but what happens afterwards? What's the end goal with this? My name is Holly Jean Buck. I'm a writer and a geographer and the author of After Geoengineering, Climate Tragedy, Repair, and Restoration. Geoengineering has been defined as large-scale interventions into the climate system to change the climate, A, intentionally, and B, at a planetary scale. Those are kind of the two defining factors of that term. But it's not a particularly helpful way to look at what's being proposed, in part because most of the scientists and researchers thinking about these technologies are not actually thinking about engineering the climate, because they know the climate's a very complex system and that engineering implies this amount of precision and design that we don't have, probably, I think, we'll never have. So it's more of a climate intervention. The other issue with the term geoengineering is that it combines a lot of techniques that are fundamentally different. Something like soil carbon storage is very different than putting particles in the atmosphere to reflect incoming sunlight. And so it's not very helpful to talk about all of these as if they were one singular thing. And so the book's entitled After Geoengineering in two senses. One is that what happens after we retire this term, what language do we have to talk about these practices? And it's also after geoengineering in the sense that perhaps geoengineering can be this time-limited phenomenon. The main point of the book is that these aren't just emerging technologies. They're really practices, infrastructures, ways of relating to the earth with social relations within them. And so how do we approach them given that climate change is really bad, is getting worse, is by some accounts a crisis or an emergency? People are going to be looking to see what else is in the so-called toolbox. There's a section on solar geoengineering, which to me is what the world might be left with if our efforts at mitigation and at carbon removal fail. Solar geoengineering is a type of intervention typically talking about putting particles into the stratosphere, which is the upper layer of the atmosphere, to reflect incoming sunlight. And those particles have a residence time of a year, maybe two. So these particles would have to be flown up into the stratosphere continually for many, many years, decades, probably centuries, until the world has mitigated and removed enough carbon to taper off this program of sunlight reflection. And so that's a very long-term program. Humanity around the world doesn't have a great track record of managing a centuries-long intervention. And so we have to think about what types of institutions, what culture, what values would guide that over the duration of multiple decades. Both solar geoengineering and carbon removal are not substitutes for mitigation and adaptation. Rather, they are possible add-ons. Carbon removal, an increasingly necessary add-on, but a lot of the policies that would see large-scale carbon removal, at a gigaton, at a billion-ton scale, like the models are showing that we would need at the end of the century, those would be achieved by the same policies as mitigation. And that's because these carbon removal technologies, like direct air capture, like bioenergy with CCS, they depend on having large-scale renewable capacity to run them, to make them carbon neutral and carbon negative. So in that way, carbon removal is not in its best case, a substitute for mitigation. There's a number of reasons why geoengineering is controversial. Probably the main one, or at least the one that concerns me the most and that I know concerns a lot of other people, is that it would reduce efforts at mitigation. It would make people or companies or politicians think that we have a cheap and easy solution at hand and we don't have to do the real work of figuring out how to transform our transportation systems, transform our built environment, transform our agricultural system, all of these things that need to be reshaped massively in the next few decades. The other concern is about unknown risks. So there's plenty of technologies that we might reference from plastics in the environment, other types of chemicals we didn't imagine probably when they were created that they might have planetary effects, and yet we see them. And this could be, people hypothesize, another thing that with imperfect knowledge, we could make an intervention and not know what the dangerous risks might be. Another concern that people have is that it's unnatural, that it's hubristic, that either God or nature wouldn't want humans to have a place in intervening in the climate system. We are caught in this binary where natural solutions are privileged and unnatural or technological or high-tech solutions are on the dark side of that binary. And it's kind of this good versus evil thing where the choice seems clear. We should be doing natural climate solutions and not relying on high technology. And I think the effect of that is, A, when it comes to this particular problem, natural climate solutions are actually quite risky because you can see how one wildfire can wipe out a large amount of carbon storage. So it's not necessarily a safe bet if you're thinking about the climate system to rely on the natural environment to hold billions of tons of carbon for long periods of time. I mean, you could see it as actually more safe to put the carbon underground into rock formations than to have it held in ecosystems. But B, I think that the other problem with this binary is that it just ignores the potential of these technologies, and it assumes that, the way they are under capitalism is like the only way that they could be. So what if we had nationalized fossil fuel companies use the technologies they've developed for enhanced oil recovery and carbon capture and storage to actually start transforming these companies to be carbon storage, carbon services companies whose function is not to produce more fossil fuels but to put carbon back underground? What if those were decent jobs in that sector for people who currently work in fossil fuel jobs? Maybe that could be a plausible way forward. But if the only answer is no, carbon capture and storage is bad because it's industrial, then I think that's pretty limiting. Because there's a moral argument to be made, actually, for carbon capture and storage, in that if you have the technology to put carbon underground and you know the carbon is causing problems worldwide for vulnerable people when it's in the atmosphere, and you have a historical responsibility if you've been a nation that's profited from fossil fuel development and emitted a lot more than other nations, then isn't it your responsibility to figure out how to put that carbon back into a safer place? I think that there is. I wanted to write for the people that I think need to know about these practices, which is a general public, in so much as one exists. I'm not particularly interested in making some theoretical intervention in some academic debate because this is a crisis. We kind of need all hands shaping these technologies. And so parts of it are reporting, more journalistic. There are parts of it that are theoretical, and there's also parts that are speculative fiction. The first part combines an introduction to the topic with the choose-your-own-adventure-style speculative fiction sequence, which allows the reader to navigate through various climate futures. And part of the aim of that is both to show that these are embodied futures, they're not just lines on a graph, they happen to actual people, but also to illustrate that there's not just one version of a 3 degrees Celsius world or a 4 degrees Celsius world. These are all particular different futures that are shaped by social choices, and it feels very different to inhabit each of them. I can anticipate how carbon removal advocates or other people that want to see kind of immediate action on climate change might say, we don't have time to look at things like the question of whose land was stolen, whose land is this really. I think that it's necessary to confront it all together, even though it's, I don't know what the right word is. I mean, difficult isn't even getting towards it. It requires such a deep rethinking. But the only way that I think we get to actual carbon removal at a large scale is through actually doing that work, having those conversations.
Holly Jean Buck's book, After Geoengineering, Climate Tragedy, Repair, and Restoration, is out now from Verso. Thinkbelt.org/interstitial has further reading, more episodes, and a small box down at the bottom where you can sign up for the newsletter. Simple. More is on the way in 2020. Subscribe to Interstitial wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks to the broadcast studio at UCLA for their help on this episode. Sound design for the show is by Sam Clapp. I'm David Huber. More next week.